This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Hey, Luke Ford here, ready to talk about the dangerous powers of the e-personality. And on today's show, it's a simulcast. I'm here with Robert Stark. He's going to be taking over, and he's going to be running his own podcast show. He's going to be asking the questions. He's going to be directing the traffic. He's going to be exerting the moral leadership. So now I am going to stop talking and let Robert Stark do his thing.
I'm here with Luke Ford. He is here to bring his message of love and inclusion and silent la la la's.
Beautiful.
So after a certain amount of silent la la la's, I hope by the end of the podcast we can be at a place of serenity.
Yeah, serenity now, bro.
So you've been discussing this book, The Virtual You, The Dangerous Powers of the E-Personality. Did you read the book? It was by a psychologist from the Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it's by a psychiatrist. I read the book and I immediately recognized the truth in it. Like, something happens to us, Robert, as soon as we go online. Like, 2 minutes ago, before you messaged me, I was kind of low energy. I was about to just like lie down for 15 minutes listening to this altright.com podcast. I had nothing to say, nothing to share. Then as soon as you message me and I go, okay, I can do it now. And I got into like game mode, and suddenly one becomes much less inhibited, because in real life, nobody listens to me for longer than 30 seconds maximum at a time without interrupting me and telling me I'm stupid. But online, nobody knows I'm a dog. Like, online, I can stream for 9 hours on a Sunday, and people will tune in and listen. And so that creates, like, first of all, a disinhibition, meaning I'm much less inhibited once I turn on that broadcast live button. And the things that would normally hold me back are just not there anymore. And so all sorts of things that are latent during the workaday world, during my real life, when I go to synagogue, they all drop away, and so I become much more revealed, and that's not always a great thing. On the other hand, I have not had to delete any of my live streams, so I've been live streaming for years.
Have you gotten any strikes from YouTube, from censorship?
Never, never. And I've never had to delete anything. I've never done something on a live stream that I then became so embarrassed about it, I said, oh, I haven't even edited any live stream I've done. I haven't gone back, deleted, edited, re-uploaded, nothing. I've never had to do that. So I have had some, you know, still some reasonable self-control, so I'm not, you know, horrifying myself by what I'm doing online, but I absolutely recognize the disinhibiting effect of going online.
So when you're online, you create an identity through this virtual persona, and you also create social status that does not exist in your day-to-day life. So do you feel your social status literally increasing as soon as you turn on your live stream as opposed to your day-to-day life?
Well, I think how much grandiosity and narcissism I grow in when I go online is pretty much a reflection of my state of psychological and spiritual health. So the more unhappy I am in real life, the more discouraged I am in real life, the more my real life isn't working, then the greater the high I'm going to get if I can go online and get some attention. But if my real life is fundamentally working, which it is today, then this is just a cherry on top. So I don't think I get as much grandiose and narcissistic rush as I did, say, when I started blogging 20 years ago.
So you're talking about when you were at your peak of journalism, you were writing about the porn industry, and then after that you were blogging about other issues, including celebrity gossip. When you were at your peak, did that have a significant effect on your overall psychological well-being?
Yeah, because it greased the skids for me plunging into grandiosity and narcissism. And even though I had a psychiatrist who diagnosed me with a personality disorder of the grandiose / narcissistic types, grandiosity and narcissism are somewhat different. So grandiosity is thinking you're much more important than you are. And that's what would happen as I started blogging. I developed this following. I was getting about 10,000 readers a day, and sometimes I'd write a particularly important, what I thought was a particularly important blog post, and I'd go for a walk, and as I'm walking, I'm saying over and over in my mind, there's a new sheriff in town, there's a new sheriff in town, there's a new sheriff in town. So I was somewhat out of touch with reality. And then the narcissism is, I need admiration. I deserve admiration, and I only want to talk to and hang out with admirable people that, you know, are of a certain caliber. And so I certainly still have that. Whenever I get an email that is misspelled, mispunctuated, with bad grammar, I just, you know, want to have nothing to do with it. I just don't want those kind of people in my life. So I'm very classist. I generally speaking, I only associate with, you know, middle class people and above. So perhaps I still have some of these tendencies. Perhaps they've just muted. But also I remember from my old days of blogging, I would often write things and then feel horrible about them a few hours later and edit them, take them down, or just feel horrible about them. And that doesn't happen now. I'm live streaming for hours a week, and I almost never feel horrible about what I've live streamed. Occasionally I'll feel, oh, that didn't go as well as I liked, or I didn't make my point as clearly as I wanted, or sometimes on one occasion I remember my stomach kind of clenching up after a show, and it often takes me hours to come down after a show. But luckily I'm not saying things that I then regret, which I used to do all the time in my earlier blogging days when I didn't have as much understanding of myself.
Do you ever get distracted at work thinking about your live streaming to the point where it interferes with your performance?
I'm sure it has at times, but not to a significant degree. I haven't been fired or lost any clients in many, many years. So I haven't gotten into car accidents on the road from live streaming.
And you did have that explosion of your radiator.
I did, but it wasn't caused by anything I did wrong in my driving. I had a radiator hose burst while I was live streaming about Serenity, and so that was an excellent test of my serenity. And I also haven't lost any friends, of which I'm aware. Maybe I've lost friends and they were, I guess, more acquaintances, and I'm not even aware of them dropping out of my life. So only about once a year do I misjudge an interpersonal interaction so that I say something that's so triggering that the person then hates me, and I've just completely blown up the relationship between us. So if I were doing that more often, then it'd be an indicator of a serious problem. But I think I can forgive myself if once a year I misjudge a social interaction. But it is very easy because of the uninhibited nature of going online, and you're asking me questions, and so that's flattering, and I enjoy giving my opinions. It's very easy to then take this personality into your real life, unless you have a level of spiritual and psychological health to realize that these are two separate worlds. And just because Robert Stark is interviewing me and asking me for my opinion, very few people in my real life are going to be similarly interested.
Have there ever been situations where your adversaries understand your psyche better than your friends?
Oh, many times. I remember there was this porn agent in 1999, Reagan Center, and I was interviewing him in 1999. He said, "You'll never be able to have a normal life as long as you make this industry the main focus of your journalism. You'll never be able to attract a decent woman. You'll never be able to, you know, settle down and get married to a decent woman. You'll never be able to hold your head high in decent society as long as you make this industry the primary focus of your writing. And those were painful truths, which were 100% true, which I wished were not true. I thought I'd find ways to get around these very difficult truths, but he saw the truth much more clearly than I did. And many times in the porn industry, I encountered people who saw me more clearly than I saw myself. For example, there was Michael Lewis Albo, who was the editor of Hustler Erotic Video Guide, and he wrote this satire of me reviewing porn films, and he called it One Effed Up Aussie's Opinion. And it was just such a dead-on imitation of my writing style and of my, you know, psyche, that when I read it to my psychologist, she was laughing so hard, she had to exert enormous effort not to pee herself. I mean, she was just dying with laughter when I read this to her, because it was so accurate and so dead on. So a lot of people in the porn industry, like Mike Albo, who absolutely had my number.
Well, yeah, and that's the whole thing with the internet. You were touching on this, is most people don't really enjoy their day-to-day lives. That maybe they tolerate it, and what's going on online is a lot more exciting, and there's this sense of escapism. But in a sense, some people have made real accomplishments online, but a lot of it is just LARPing, where they live vicariously for this online persona, and they have this sense of excitement, like they're maybe fighting this great battle or they're fighting for a great cause. But in some ways, like, are they really doing that, or is it just LARPing?
Well, it varies by individual, but overall, the internet bestows far more fame on people doing things of little importance rather than people who are doing things of great importance. For example, a Google search of Matt Harding reveals about 600,000 results at the time of the writing of this book in 2011. He's the guy who did those, you know, Dancing with Matt videos around the world, while a Google search of Rudolf Nureyev, often considered the best ballet dancer in the history of the world, gets a mere 300,000 results. So, you know, Matt Harding has achieved far more online fame than Rudolf. I remember for years, the number one result for various search engines for the word Luke was my website. I got, like, more attention, more traffic, you know, more pull online than the Gospel of Luke or, you know, any other Luke in history. Obviously, that was not proportionate to my accomplishment, and it's no longer true. But it's very easy to produce, you know, big dreams online, to get, you know, fleeting amounts of attention for doing something of no significance. For instance, you know, there's Paris Hilton gets far more attention than some worthy professor at UCLA.
You mentioned becoming more uninhibited online, and that's definitely the case, depending on whether, I mean, some people use pseudonyms, and that leads to problems, of course, but even if you use your real name, becoming uninhibited can create a sense of euphoria, and it increases your level of confidence, but it can also cause you to say things that you wouldn't say to someone at your job.
Yeah, it's very easy to get out of touch with reality. So humility is simply being in touch with reality, and humiliation is being caught out of touch with reality. So imagining that you're more important to your employer, so you start making demands, and as a result, your employer fires you. So you got out of touch with reality. You thought you were more important than you really were. And so going online and having a voice, and say just being interviewed by Robert Stark, it would be easy for me to, you know, go forward out of this interview with the expectation that other people that I interact with will be similarly interested in my opinions, and 99.5% of the time that's simply not going to be the case. So if you get out of touch with reality because you get so euphoric online, that can have a tremendously humiliating effect on your real life.
And when you're online, you create your own universe where you feel a sense of power. A lot of people feel the sense of powerlessness in their day-to-day lives. Do you ever feel the sense of feeling small in a big world?
Oh, yeah. Powerless? Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, for almost all of us, our workaday lives are not that exciting and are not that rewarding, and it's very easy to feel small in a big world and feel powerless, and then to go online and just, you know, get all grandiose. You can just kind of create this better life for yourself online than you have in real life, and then you spend more and more time online, and then as you spend more time online, you become less suited to reality. You spend less time in the real world and more time in the online world, so that your ability to read and respond to social cues declines, and you get an exaggerated sense of your own abilities and your own importance, and then that leads to more failure and more humiliation in real life, leading you to devote even more resources and time and attention to your online life, which then is just this destructive cycle. So luckily for me, in the past few years, I've been able to get much of the spiritual and psychological help I needed from 12-step programs. Many of the meetings are face-to-face. You see real people. You hear their real struggles. You share your own real struggles. And you start to get an understanding of your own resentments. Basically, any uncomfortable feeling you have about another person indicates that you probably have some amends to make there. And if you're going through life, you know, bumping into people that you feel uncomfortable about means you've got a lot of amends to make. But once you make those amends, once you make right the wreckage of the past, then you can sail through life feeling pretty good 90% of the time. You can be happy, joyous, and free. And then your online life is just the cherry on top. It's just a nice little added extra. Just like for some people, they come home, they have one cocktail, and that's it. But for other people, they come home, they have, you know, three cocktails and a bottle of wine over dinner, and that's obviously destructive.
And you obviously use your real name, and there's these dangers of using pseudonyms. A lot of people use pseudonyms for obvious reasons, because they want to protect their identity because of their job, but there are dangers to that, because what happens is you get these individuals who become very reckless using these pseudonyms, and they say really outrageous things that they wouldn't say under their real name, and then they're still taking a major risk of being doxxed.
Yeah, and forgetting being doxxed, it shapes your personality. Like, everything you do affects other people. That's one of the quotes attributed to me in online quote books. And so when you go online and develop this fake persona or a pseudonym, everything you write is going to have an effect on you. So if you start getting a tremendous amount of pleasure out of torturing people online, out of trolling people online, out of putting people down online after, you know, massacring people personally online, that's going to spill into your real life, and you're going to start taking those same character traits into your day-to-day life with often disastrous consequences. Now, if you're high IQ, if you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're a dentist, you're a highly accomplished person, you're going to be much less likely to blow up your life from these sort of practices. So there are a lot of vices that high IQ people can get away with that will completely destroy someone with an average or a below average IQ. So I noticed with many of the online trolls, it's very much, you know, average and IQ. And so their trolls are misspelled. They're just, you know, vicious, nasty, badly punctuated, poor grammar. And these people, as they get a high from being nasty online, they're not going to have the abstract cognitive abilities to understand the difference between, you know, the online world and the real world. And these nasty trolling traits are much more likely to spill over into their real life with absolutely disastrous effects, even if they never get doxxed.
Do you get a strong sense of narcissistic supply when you receive a super chat?
I get a financial high. I get probably some narcissistic supply. So remember, on a scale of 1 to 10, if you're a 10 on the narcissism checklist, you're going to be in jail. I mean, if you're a 9 or a 10, you're going to be in jail. I don't think I was ever more than a 7. I've never been arrested, let alone jail. I've never led a criminal life. I've never, you know, come close to committing something.
For ethical reasons, or would you be nervous about going to jail?
I think both. It's just not the way I was raised, and it's not the way I think I'm genetically predisposed. Anglos create certain types of societies. So I was never that, and you know, while I've had my struggles in the sex and love arena, I've never been tempted to expose myself in public. I've never been tempted to solicit underage sex. I've never solicited a hooker. I've never had a lap dance. I've never touched drugs or alcohol to excess. So there are a lot of things that were never an issue for me. But I did have a disabling amount of narcissism and grandiosity that made it difficult for me to develop and sustain relationships and friendships. And so when I was at a seven, I was much more vulnerable to narcissistic supply than, you know, my self-perception is I'm probably at a four now, or maybe I'm a five now. So I'm less vulnerable than I used to be. Now, as far as super chats and their effect on me, it basically depends on how much money is behind the super chat. This week, I had a $100 super chat. So how did I react to that? I went, whoa. And it's not just the super chat. It means, hey, maybe I can make this my life, and that maybe I can quit doing other things that are less interesting, less exciting for me, and just concentrate on streaming. I would love to do that. And when I saw that $100 super chat, immediately my mind thought, oh, you know, this is a possibility. Just like Andy Worski makes a living from Worski Live, you know, maybe I can make a living from my YouTube streams. And when you get a $100 super chat, makes you think, yeah, this is possible.
In Orthodox life and Jewish culture in general, if you're not profiting from your live stream, do they view you as kind of a nut or a loser?
Yes. Yeah. Like, I don't think Jews put too much emphasis on success and making money. To me, it's an appropriate level of emphasis, but it's a far greater emphasis than I knew when I was an Anglo-Saxon, than I knew when I was a Protestant, and it's a far greater emphasis, generally speaking, that non-Jews give on success and making money. There was a convert to Orthodox Judaism who devoted himself to teaching in Jewish day schools, and when it came time for retirement, he just realized that he never received any, he received very little respect in the community because he never made much money. And making money is really important. It's really important in Jewish life. And so if I do these streams and no one throws in a super chat, people would just think I'm crazy. They'd think I'm a total loser, and possibly that I have nefarious motives, and it's just sad and pathetic. But if I can bank some serious bank from doing these live streams, and people go, oh, that's great, that's creative, you know, you found a new way of making money, you know, you talk about Hitler and Mein Kampf and the alt-right all you like, if you're making a panasa, if you're making a living off of it, then it's good and holy, and you can donate to Jewish causes, and you know, we'll give you honor and respect.
And also with online identity, and this is especially true with people who use pseudonyms, but even people use their real name, you can also lie about your social status, so you can lie about how much money you make, and you can create these false identities, and sometimes it does benefit people, but there's a high chance of it backfiring.
Yeah, and it's not so much the matter of being doxxed, it's just that you're very likely to develop character traits. Unless you're a fundamentally grounded and good person who's psychologically and spiritually healthy, you're very likely to go off the rails if you engage in flaming under an anonymous handle, because it just incentivizes, you know, horrible traits, which if you indulge in them online in your e-personality, you're going to come out in your real-life personality, so you'll be more short and abrupt or even rude and mocking and cutting in a work email or to a client or to a friend or to a member of your religious community, and that will have very negative consequences. And I remember that did happen to me. I lost touch. I'm thinking of some very embarrassing examples. I met this older woman at synagogue, and we just really hit it off. It was not going to be anything romantic, but we just interpersonally just really hit it off. And then I received this like hysterical denunciation from Hypatia Lee, a porn star, and I just found it so funny that for some reason I thought it related to my conversation with this older, very professional Jewish woman, and I forwarded it to her. She was absolutely horrified, and I never really had a chance to talk to her again. She said, you know, never send me anything like that again. And so I was just completely out of touch with reality. And another time I had a good female friend at synagogue. I'd always sit with her every week. And again, something I found funny that someone had emailed to me, I forwarded to her, and she was so offended. You know, she didn't want to talk to me. Eventually, I managed to make amends. But this happened to me again and again and again. Things that I found very funny, other people found appalling and caused them to distance from me. And also, the other thing that I'll never realize how much, like, real-life connection I've sacrificed by living so much of my life online. There are a substantial number of people who just simply don't feel safe about me in case, you know, I talk about them, even if I keep them completely anonymous, just like if I just make any stray reference to anything that might somewhat relate to them would just be horrifying to them, and therefore, as a result, they will have nothing to do with me. So how many examples of real-life connection, you know, real-life togetherness and bonding have I sacrificed by devoting so much of my life to online efforts, to disclosing so much of my life, to blogging about controversial issues? So it's I won't even know the harm that I've done for myself. I remember telling one therapist that one reason I didn't want to stop blogging was that I remembered how humiliating it was to convert to Orthodox Judaism, and I needed to keep my blog in case any more rabbis tried humiliating me. I needed to have some kind of defense.
Are you talking about that rabbi who was involved in the sex scandals?
Well, no, not just him, but he did have a very sharp insight into me. He said, I get the feeling from you that somebody in religious authority abused their authority with regard to you. And yeah, that's true. I was often humiliated as a child by people in religious authority. So I have this predisposition to hate people who to me seem to abuse religious authority to humiliate me. So I tried to develop this strong, you know, blog following so that I would have a defense in case, you know, rabbis went around humiliating me like I thought they did in the past. And my therapist said, well, what if you could only get well if you put down your weapon? It was a profound insight.
Have there been instances where you've made comments that are either politically inappropriate or sexually lewd in a school setting or a work setting that have harmed your social connections or even your work connections?
Yeah, I mean, that happened all the time, particularly when I first came to Los Angeles. I was on a drug called Nardil, N-A-R-D-I-L, and that had a disinhibiting effect, and I was on that till 1999. So my first 5 years in Los Angeles, I frequently said things and even did things that just destroyed my reputation in the community. I remember there was this one girl that I kind of cornered in the kitchen at a Shabbat dinner, and I think I probably put my hand on her shoulder or on her waist. And apparently, I can't even recall who it was, but I just hear about it secondhand. Like, you know, years and years later, she would go to rabbis saying they should not allow me in their synagogue. She will, you know, come to tears when she thinks about how traumatizing that incident in the kitchen was. Other people recall me saying, like, really crude, sexually charged comments at Kiddush, which is, you know, when the rabbi is making a blessing over wine. Apparently, I was, like, hitting on the rabbi's daughter. So I did all sorts of horrible things. And, of course, as I aged, I became more and more careful. But getting a blog and having an audience to the world, that did have a disinhibiting effect, which probably also carried out into my real life and damaged a lot of potential opportunities for human connection, left me somewhat isolated and depressed and lonely, and then more predisposed to eroticized rage, more predisposed to seeking narcissistic supply, more predisposed to, you know, spending hours of my day just grandiosely dreaming, and just didn't leave me in a good place. So these cycles kind of build on themselves. The more you alienate yourself from other people, the more lonely I would get. The more lonely I would get, the more bizarre I would act and speak. The more bizarre I would act and speak, the more alienated I would get from other people. And it was just a vicious cycle. And it got to the point why, by about 2006, 2007, 2008, I was just constantly going around saying, I'm effed. I'm so effed. This is effed. I'm effed. I'm just totally effed up. And it was just you know, this really negative cycle in my thinking, because I had just blown up so many bridges. I was just so hopeless about my life. I just couldn't get out of my own way.
Do you ever have this feeling that you know all the grand truths to life and to either it's religion or politics, just like that you're a genius and you know the great truths, and this strong sense of frustration that people don't see the world the way you see it, and wanting to kind of impose your point of view in people, and feeling a strong sense of rage when people don't understand your worldview?
Not anymore, and I don't think I ever had it to the extent that you just described, but I had intimations of it. So the more shaky my own life was operating, you know, the more shaky my own handle on reality, the more desperate I was to convert other people to my way of thinking. The more smoothly my life was operating, the more in touch with reality I've become, the less psychological need I've felt to change the people around me.
Is it worth expressing the truth if it harms your social status or overall well-being? This is obviously a big issue for the alt-right, but you give the parallel example that Jews view Christianity as idolatry, but they don't necessarily go around saying that because it would harm their interactions with Gentiles. So is it worth expressing the full truth, or should people tone down their views to help their interactions?
Virtually never. Almost never should you ever say anything to somebody that they are not able to handle. The only possible exception is if you're a public figure or willing to be a public figure who has an opportunity to push ideas, you know, send them out into the world by accepting the arrows of outrageous fortune. Then possibly if you're speaking to a reporter, or even if you're doing a live stream, or you decided to become a public personality, and what you're saying, there is potential for good things to come from it. So I'm very outspoken in my streams, but people only come to my streams if they're interested in what I have to say. I'm not outspoken in real life, and it's very rare that I misread a social interaction. I don't talk about my religious, political, cultural views, you know, except with the very few people who are able to hear them.
There's this whole concept of compare and despair. Do you ever struggle with jealousy over people who have greater social status, money, or sex?
Yeah. Much less than I used to, but it still comes up. And that's kind of when I know I need to get on my knees. I need to pray to God. I need to make a program call. I need to talk to my sponsor. I need to journal about what I'm grateful for. I need to do my step work. It's a flashing warning sign, such as another flashing warning sign for me is lust. I just have no use for lust in my life right now, as I'm not in a sexual relationship. So lust does me no good, and if my mind starts going in that direction, then I'm like an alcoholic who's starting to obsess about having a drink. So I need to stop it as quickly as possible. When my life is going the most smoothly, I probably spend less than 5 minutes a day in lust. But when that time starts ticking up over 20 minutes, 30 minutes to an hour, I realize I'm in trouble, and I've got to make some changes and deal with it, or it's going to spill out in ways that are going to do me harm.
You had a one-man play titled Eroticized Rage, and that's something you mentioned you struggled with. Talk about your struggles, and what is the worst-case outcome of eroticized rage?
Oh, well, eroticized rage is anger that's been sexualized. And for me, I never came close to the worst-case outcomes, which would be criminal behavior. So I never came close to rape or child molestation or even affairs with married women. I've always stayed completely away from messing around with married women. But for me, it just meant in my intimate relationships, I was pursuing intensity more than intimacy. So I was always looking for, you know, new scenarios, you know, new things to experiment with to up the intensity of the interaction, rather than using sex as a bridge towards intimacy. And I would also kind of go through the day like looking for erotic interludes or erotic hits that I can store up and use in some kind of erotic fantasy. And so I wasn't really present for a lot of my interactions with people or for my work, because I was just so desperately in need of some kind of erotic hit or erotic high. And it was wonderful, I found, when I completely ceased masturbation, you know, entered a 12-step program, pursued the 12 steps towards sexual sobriety, and suddenly the hours a day that I'd spent lost in sexual fantasy started dropping to under 30 minutes a day on average, to under 20 minutes a day on average, and my life suddenly became really smooth, and I was able to interact with women like they were people, because I wasn't going to be able to use those interactions in some kind of erotic fantasy. And so if I was talking to the cashier at work, that's all it was. I wasn't trying to look down at top. I wasn't, you know, trying to arrange how I could, you know, seek her out, you know, afterwards, or imagine scenarios in which we'd get together. I was able to free up my mind for a much more normal life. And so letting go of that obsession, kind of getting out of that downward cycle of rage, and I was using that rage to kind of buck myself up, to imagine that I was a really important person who could, you know, command women to fulfill my sexual needs. I was able to get out of that, you know, hate-fueled fantasy and move into reality and just deal with people on a normal basis, and life became a lot easier.
When you teach Alexander technique, a lot of your clients are attractive women, including actresses and models. How do you practice restraint?
Actually, it's been pretty easy because, well, it's hard to get the truth from other male teachers. Like, are they really going to tell you? Like, if they ever admitted that they did something inappropriate, it could be the absolute death of their teaching practice. But for me, it's been pretty easy. You just go into that teaching mode. So I haven't even had to struggle with it. So I don't think I've had to spend time on my knees praying that I, you know, don't misbehave. It hasn't even been welling up from under the surface. I just get into teaching mode. But if I wasn't in recovery, and, you know, it would be possible that on a lonely day, you know, when I was feeling down, that I'd start looking to my clients for emotional solace, you know, forget, you know, any sexual or physical interaction, but just kind of looking for their admiration or their affection or their love to buck me up. And that would definitely handicap me as a teacher. It would probably creep them out, and it could lead to, you know, an escalation of inappropriate behavior. But so far, I found just being in teacher mode, that I'm here to transmit certain principles of how the body moves. I haven't had a problem, of which I'm aware. Who knows? I may have said something that offended a client and they just didn't say anything. But I don't think it's been an issue. But obviously, the more spiritually and psychologically centered, the better my teaching is, because every teacher, you know, transmits their own psychology through their work. And so all their flaws are going to come out. If they're codependent, if they have eroticized rage, you know, whatever their problem is psychologically is going to come out in their Alexander Technique teaching sessions, which are very intimate. And so your real self becomes revealed. So if your real self has a lot of needy elements, or needs to dominate, or is afraid of intimacy, or pushes people away, that's all going to come out in an Alexander Technique session. So the more I can grow spiritually and psychologically, the more pure my Alexander Technique sessions can be, the more effectively I can transmit the Alexander Technique to other people. And, you know, I'm better off when I'm not looking in the workplace to meet my psychological needs for love and affection, but to, you know, reserve the meeting of those needs for their appropriate place, and not allowing them to spill over into my professional or social or religious life.
Does the internet provide a sense of community for people who are lacking healthy social bonds in real life?
Oh, yeah, it's huge. I mean, I don't think anybody comes to my streams on the wings of victory. Like, I think, you know, the people who come to my streams must somehow identify with the various ways that I am broken. It perhaps speaks to them for things that they're struggling with in their life. And so, yeah, a lot of people who struggle with real-life interactions then try to, you know, interact online, but that can actually, sometimes that can do good, but often it can lead to downward destructive cycle where people try to create a whole new self online that becomes increasingly unhinged with who they really are. And then when they interact with people online, they're going to likely interact with other people who are similarly making it up. See, when you achieve a level of psychological and spiritual health, you can immediately tell when people are lying to you or trying to manipulate you. You just immediately get that sense. You'll notice if you know highly developed people, they will often tell that you're lying before you realize that you're lying. And they'll often call you on it and you'll go, whoa, you know, that person really called me out and he was absolutely right. I didn't even know that I was trying to deceive him or manipulate him. So when you understand how you work, then you're much less likely to get taken in, because lying is a cooperative act. It takes two people for a lie to work. So for a lie to work with me, it has to appeal to my vulnerable side. So from growing up in childhood, anyone comes along and offers, you know, some sort of like maternal nurturing, I'm vulnerable to that. Someone who comes along and offers like some kind of admiration for my narcissistic side is vulnerable to that. Someone who feeds my grandiosity, I'm vulnerable to that. So when people plug into those weaknesses in my psyche, they can effectively lie and manipulate me. But if I'm in recovery, if I'm aware of my tendency to be selfish and self-seeking and inconsiderate and dishonest and fearful, and I've admitted these problems to other people, and I've made amends for the wreckage of my past, then when people come along trying to manipulate me and deceive me, I just spot it like that. Like when I'm in a good psychological, spiritual state, people don't fool me. I just immediately something feels off and I realize that someone's lying to me either consciously or unconsciously. But when you aren't at a strong spiritual, psychological state, people are just going to be able to lead you around by the nose by just pinging into your weaknesses, your needs for affection or respect or admiration, and then they can very effectively deceive you.
Why do you say that the people who follow your stream are broken individuals?
Because I think we all attract people like attracts like. And so, obviously, I'm 51 years old. I have nothing saved for retirement. I just recently paid off $50,000 in credit card debt. I've never married. I don't have children. Widely regarded as a loser in my adopted spiritual community. Pretty much everyone I grew up with is married with children and a mortgage and a career that is moving forward. So by most conventional standards, I'm a loser. And so why are people coming here to listen to what I have to say? It's because there are things in what I have to say or in my experience or things that I'm struggling with that resonate with them. If it didn't resonate with them, they wouldn't be interested in the stream. It would just be pathetic, or it'd just be dysfunctional, or it just would be on a tone, on a level that just doesn't speak to them. Like we all transmit with our words, with our actions, with our demeanor, and so people pick up the signals that we transmit. So for instance, all of my girlfriends have had fathers who are sex addicts. So obviously I would ping certain thing, and then women who had these traumatic experiences with fathers who are sex addicts, something about me would resonate with these most intense emotional experiences of their childhood, and so they'd try to heal that trauma of having a father who was a sex addict by hooking up with me, a sex addict, and trying to fix me and thereby heal the most painful part of their past. And obviously that didn't really work for them or for me, and we all tend to do that. We all tend to try to recreate the most emotionally intense experiences of our past, and we look at people not so much as they are, but through the lens of our experience. So, for example, I've always looked for substitute father figures. I kind of grew up in foster care. Then my dad was very busy out preaching and saving the world, and so I was always looking for substitute father figures, and always looking for substitute mother figures, and kind of always, to some sense in my psyche, felt like an orphan. I always kind of given off this lost dog vibe. I always struck people who, you know, have some degree of spiritual and psychological sensitivity as a lost dog looking for a home. And so I'd kind of put that vibe out into the world, and then people would come along and get that vibe and want to adopt me. But the urge to rescue, it doesn't last long. Eventually you get sick of the stray dog that you've adopted, and you get tired of rescuing people, and then you just look to get rid of them. And so I would bounce along feeling lonely and dejected, then I'd get adopted and I'd feel whole and happy, but then the people who adopted me would get tired and want to get rid of me, and so then I'd get rejected again, and it would feel like my childhood when I kept moving through these different foster homes, only the feelings get more intense as you age, and all these feelings just get turned around like you're in a dryer, and you're just getting bounced around, the feelings are more intense, you're more disoriented, because the sweetness of having that genuine connection and of being genuinely adopted for a few weeks or a few months, it just tastes so sweet, and then you lose it, but you have the memory of what it feels like to be whole, and so in a sense, you're even worse off afterward.
Does being in a community that puts such a strong pressure on being successful and starting a family and status, does that add extra pressure to your life and feelings of inadequacy?
Yeah, it's more intense. So it just makes everything more intense. So, for example, moving was very traumatic. A few years ago, I had to move. And realizing what I could purchase, you know, with my financial funds available, like, was just a very unpleasant experience of reality that really shook me up. It was just a horrible experience psychologically, not the logistics of it. The logistics of it was just fine. But psychologically, it just made me realize what a loser I was. Then on the Jewish Sabbath, there are all these limitations on what you can do. You can't stream. You know, I can't go online. I can't blog. I can't lose myself in Netflix and movies. So I have to confront reality. And if it's a Sabbath or a Jewish holiday where I don't have any invites, where nobody wants to make me a part of their home, it can be very lonely, and you're confronting yourself. You're having to look in the mirror and see the situation of your life. Or during the workaday week, you can distract yourself from the true reality of your life, and you can go online and you can live in a world of fantasy. Oh, because, you know, I can bring 60 people into my stream right now and talk about the dangers of the e-personality. It means, hey, I've got something to say. But on the Sabbath, on Jewish holidays, when I can't stream and I'm alone, and I can't live in that world of my e-personality anymore. Now I have to confront reality. Now I have to confront where I'm really at in life. Now I have to understand, you know, how many people want me around. What is the quality of my bonds with my community and with my friends? And I may go for a walk, and I may say Shabbat Shalom to people, and they don't say anything. And that's a really lousy feeling. I tend to say Shabbat Shalom to everyone who's obviously Jewish when I'm out for a walk and on the Sabbath, and I don't know, maybe at some points, like, it seemed like half of the people wouldn't respond. And or other times I'd go for a walk on the Sabbath with a friend, and they would feel and experience these really weird stares that they were out with me, but they were just like going for a walk with me. Other people would, like, look at them as though there was something wrong with them, like, what the hell are you thinking? And so my friends picked up that vibe. And then I remember I had a co-host on one of my streams who made the point to me that, look, nobody's social status is enhanced by being seen talking with you. He wasn't wanting to be nasty. He was just telling the truth.
And but haven't you interviewed a number of semi-famous celebrities?
Yeah, I have interviewed a number of semi-famous celebrities, and I guess they had enough, you know, fame that my bad reputation did not rub off on them. But, yeah, so embracing reality, you know, as long as I can live in reality, then I don't get humiliated. For instance, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of trying to join a conversation where you're not wanted.
Oh, sure.
I've had that experience probably 1,000 times in my life. But it's been many months since I've had that experience, and it's considerably lessened over the past few years, because now I'm better able to see when there's a conversation I'm not wanted, and at least I don't say anything. Because when you say something in a conversation where you're not wanted and people just ignore you, it's just a horrible feeling inside. Or particularly when you're older, like I'm 51, and you try to go to events that are meant for people in their 20s. That once happened to me, and it was just a horrible feeling to be to be notified that you weren't wanted at these events because you weren't in the age range. So that's like getting out of touch with reality. That was humiliation because I wasn't willing to live in reality.
Is that what you mean when you say stay in your lane?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things I mean. If you're not wanted in a conversation, don't join it. You know, shut the F up. If your opinion's not wanted, don't give it. If you don't have expertise in something, don't talk like you do have expertise in it. So yeah, stay in your lane. And I also literally mean it driving. You know, generally speaking, stay in your lane. Don't weave in and out of lanes as you drive. Much more likely to have an accident.
Do you think that the alt-right tends to attract people who lack healthy social connections in real life, including mental illness? Is that part of the reason why the movement is collapsing?
Yeah, and that's the way white nationalism has always been a marginalized, unsuccessful movement, because the movement itself is marginal, and so it attracts marginalized people who, by and large, are not as healthy as accomplished people. Their criminal records, their criminal predispositions, they're very easy to get into feuds and to fighting with each other. Since Trump's election, the alt-right has devoted far more resources and time and attention to hating on each other and to fighting with each other than to fighting with the enemy. And so this is a reflection of a very sick movement. And the whole optics debate is really a lack of comfort with who are the strongest supporters of the alt-right. They're not, when people see, you know, who went to Shelbyville, and these are the representatives of the alt-right, you know, most normal people are horrified. And so a movement devoting so much time to debating optics is an indication of a movement in grave peril, and a movement that's spiraling downward. Like, I can't think of anything parallel to that. It's not normal for a movement to devote so much energy to optics, and that only happens when you're fundamentally uncomfortable with who you are, like who your group is, who is responding to your message. So I think Jared Taylor has the right idea when he puts forth a message that attracts a higher quality of people, who he insists that they dress in suits and ties and formal attire when they come to his gatherings. That, again, weeds out the skinheads and the criminally predisposed. So the type of people that you attract is a reflection of you. So I am excited by the quality of people that I attract to my streams. The points are just so smart.
Are they primarily alt-right or Orthodox Jews?
Oh, they're about 80% Daily Stormer and Right Stuff types, and I'd say less than 10% Jewish.
Are some of them people you see in Shul and they're like, hey, Luke, I just saw your live stream?
Occasionally, but people, I'm under no illusion that every word I say will filter around. Like, Orthodox Judaism is very insular, and so everything people do and say within it, you know, gets filtered around and people find out. But on the other hand, you know, very few people in my religious community are paying attention to my streams. They would only do that if I went outside the bounds of what is permissible. So on the one hand, most people in the chat won't realize this, but pretty much everything I'm saying is within the permissible bounds of Orthodox Judaism, because I'm saying it, I'm still part of the community, I haven't been thrown out of anywhere because of my streams, I haven't lost any friendships or any connections. And so if I did exceed the boundaries of what is permitted, I would find out very quickly, I'd be excluded, I would be expelled. But it's important to me to speak from within Orthodox Judaism, which is not saying that I represent Orthodox Judaism, but I am within that community.
And do Orthodox Jews care less about political correctness and the kind of topics that are controversial that you talk about than, say, if you were attending a Reform synagogue and how they would react?
Yes, though the more modern Orthodox are more politically correct.
So you're modern or ultra-Orthodox?
I don't affiliate with any particular type of Orthodox Judaism. I'm comfortable from the modern to the Hasidic to the traditional to the Yeshivish. I'm equally comfortable in all those different Orthodox worlds. I don't promote or identify with any one particular approach to Orthodox Judaism, but generally speaking, the more traditional you go on the Orthodox spectrum, the less politically correct people are.
So Orthodox Jews obviously have a community as thriving as far as social bonds. They have demographic growth, and they're economically prosperous. Why don't you see Northern European whites doing the same thing in a place like L.A.?
Well, I think they do. I think Episcopalians are highly successful, highly intelligent people. It depends on the group of Northern European whites who are here. But by and large, I think Northern Europeans who are in Los Angeles are successful.
There's individuals who are successful economically, but they tend to be more individualistic, and they're declining demographically.
Yeah, that's true. So I think because Northern Europeans aren't as well suited for between group competition, I think they have thousands of years of successfully competing with a very harsh and isolating environment. And Jews come from the Middle East, where all sorts of different groups are always marching, you know, over the top of Israel. And so Jews developed a lot of skills at between group competition, at reading people to see whether they were scam artists or not, being able to, you know, deal with different groups. So being able to speak black to blacks, being able to speak Mexican to Mexicans, being able to speak race realism to race realists, being able to speak, you know, globalism and egalitarianism to people who hold that philosophy. Jews are a quintessential middleman minority, is able to speak differently to different groups, is able to deal righteously with the righteous and deal wickedly with the wicked, kind of relate to groups based on how those groups relate to Jews. So I don't think people of Northern European origins are as skilled at the middleman minority role. I don't think they're as skilled at speaking differently to different groups. I think they often tend to put principles ahead of the well-being of their people, while Jews tend to put the well-being of their people ahead of abstract principles.
And they don't seem to do well as being a minority. Even Mediterranean whites in South America do better as a minority. It seems with Northern Europeans, they need a homogeneous country to thrive.
Yeah, because when you've got a universalist morality and you're competing with people who practice dual morality, meaning one morality for your own group and then a much more relaxed morality for outsiders, obviously people with the universalist morality are at a disadvantage, and people of Northern European heritage overwhelmingly practice and see the world through the lens of universal morality, while virtually everybody else in the world sees the world through the lens of dual morality. So that puts Northern Europeans at a substantial disadvantage in between group competition.
Do you see it as inevitable that European Americans will become a minority, and do you see that as a negative trend?
Oh, I absolutely see it as a negative trend. I think Europe and what Europeans have created in Canada, United States, and Australia is the very epitome of high trust first world civilization. So every day California becomes more like Mexico, and I don't like that. I don't want to live in Mexico. I want to live in a high-trust Anglo society. Anglo-Saxons have created the most high-trust, you know, best countries in the world. And I like what Anglo-Saxons have made. And Los Angeles used to be the most Anglo-Saxon major city in the United States prior to World War II. Now it's just more Mexican every day with all the problems, the crime. I mean, when Mexicans come here, they bring crime, they bring drugs, they're rapists. And some, I guess, are good people, but I don't like to go to the beach and see the fat ones wading in the ocean with their T-shirts on. I just find it unsightly. Like, no Anglo-Saxon would do that.
So what do you see as the solution? Is this an inevitable trend?
Oh, love and inclusion. Study of the Bible. Embracing the 12 steps. I see freedom of association. Like, I think when you promote an ethno-state, that just energizes your enemies, you know, 100,000 times more than you can energize your own devotees. So I think it's best to support anodyne things like freedom of association, love and inclusion, you know, God, you know, go to church, move ahead in your career. To me, when you take the red pill, it should lead to you making more money. It shouldn't lead to you getting discombobulated so you get fired. It should lead to improved relationships with your family and friends. not destroyed relationships with your family and friends. Stop the Nazi lopping and the KKK lopping, and lead a prosperous life, get married, have kids. And if you say anything publicly, make sure it's anodyne. Because, like, why would you want... That's the Jewish way. Like, Jews don't go out of their ways, you know, telling Christians that you're idolaters. And, you know, Jews don't tell Muslims you're dogs. Or, you know, Jews don't tell white people that they're stupid. Jews want to get along with everyone because they're a middleman minority. And so now the white people are a minority in much of the United States. They need to learn to get along and not say things publicly that are going to fire up their enemies. So just say anodyne things, say nice things, go to church, take back your church from the communists.
And that's the thing with
do things that aren't going to get you fired and doxxed and humiliated and destroyed.
That's the thing with the alt-right. They're obsessed with stating the truth, or their version of the truth, whichever take you have. But would you say it's more important to be prosperous and to start families than to express political views?
Oh, yeah. The only reason to express political views that will result in repercussions is an extraordinary individual like Jared Taylor. Okay, there is a place for extraordinary individuals to say unpopular truths, but it's grandiose, it's delusional, it's narcissistic to imagine that you are such a person, unless you're that one person in 100,000 who has the cognitive ability and the charm and the successful life of a Jared Taylor. But there are very few Jared Taylors, and most people would be better off not saying things publicly that are going to come back to hurt them.
And, I mean, he's made tremendous sacrifices. I'm sure if he was, like, a mainstream normie conservative, he would be much wealthier.
Yeah, he's made sacrifices, but he's always lived in reality. He's always supported his family. He's had a nice home. He makes a lucrative living translating Japanese to English, English to Japanese in court cases. And so if you have that kind of backup, you have more room to be able to speak out on controversial issues if you're sure that you're still going to be able to make a living.
And back to the whole topic of the internet, to kind of summarize this show, a lot of these movements, they just primarily exist online, but they have made some attempts to form communities or social gatherings in real life. But that's a big issue. I'd say primarily a lot of this stuff just exists online. And to kind of summarize the show, people don't always behave the most mature when you have like a community online, because it lacks that sense of authenticity of something that's organic, that's been around for a long time.
Yeah, people should realize that you're stepping into a stream that is flowing in a certain direction whenever you go online. So the stream is always flowing towards disinhibition. You're becoming less inhibited when you go online. The stream is always flowing towards grandiosity. The stream will always make you feel that you're more important than you are. There will be a strong push in that direction. The stream is always flowing towards narcissism, that you're deserving of admiration and praise and should only hang out with superior people. The stream is always heading towards morbidity. Going online and expressing yourself, there will always be a push to express the darker parts of yourself that you would never normally express in public. And the stream will always push you towards impulsivity, just reacting without thinking through the consequences. So these are the inevitable pushes and pulls of the stream that happens when you go online and start speaking out or shopping, all these things. And so the more grounded you are, the more psychologically and spiritually strong you are, the less vulnerable you're going to be to these tides and currents. But these tides and currents still exist, even if you're a 10 out of 10 on the spiritual scale. So being cognitive of what's going on and being careful about is your e-personality, your online persona reconfiguring your real true self in your real true life in a way that is hurting your connection with other people. If you're getting fired, if you're losing friends, if you're losing income, these are all warning signs that your online persona has infected and negatively affected your real life.
So, Luke, should we end this show on some more silent lalas? Thanks, Luke. It's been an excellent show. Take care.